This is John Radecki, December 9th, 1991. Individuation's Most Dangerous Servant, The Psychopath.
Welcome to the Monday, December 9th lecture at the Jung Society of Seattle. This lecture will be by John Radecki. The title is Individuation's Most Dangerous Servant, The Psychopath.
He has a master's in counseling, and when he arrived in the United States, he says he was, I don't know a quite word to describe, but he had some dreams that just really shook him and started to shape how he moved in his existence, and the unconscious became very real and alive to him. And since that time, he's basically followed what his unconscious has told him to listen to. And tonight's lecture is a result of that, and he says it's actually been 2 years in the making. So, and it comes out of his own personal experience during a dark time of his life. And so this is really a personal exploration that you'll hear about tonight, too.
Where's he from?
Australia. Thank you.
And England.
Most recently,
Australia.
So, that's I actually included everything in here, which was that this talk is 2 years in the making. So, without further ado, please help me welcome John Radecki.
Well, good evening and welcome. This is a very dark topic, and so, as Carl mentioned, it did come out of some personal experiences of my own. It was only later that I began to connect up my experiences to what is collectively known about the psychopath. So tonight's talk has some rough edges. I couldn't possibly fit all that I wanted to say into 2 hours, but I'm hoping that I can raise enough points for you to be interested in following up on what I have to say. But first, let me put the whole talk into context, because it is such a dark subject. The psychopathic energy is one of the dark powers of the human psyche, and so I wanted to just to put the talk into context so you can better understand why I'm interested in it at all, and why I'm interested in presenting it to you, and perhaps why you're interested in coming to hear it. Let me begin elucidating the context by giving you the first stanza of a poem by W.B. Yeats. It's the poem, The Second Coming. It begins, "The falcon cannot hear the falconer, things fall apart. The center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Tonight, I will not be full of passionate intensity. And the second quote I want to give, is from Jung, and he says, "We have no dominance anymore. They are in the future. Our values are shifting. Everything loses its certainty." Now, those two quotes, the poem and Jung's quotes, set the stage for a description of our times that we're in. And we are, as you all know, at the age of a millennium. And apparently, according to our historical research, such a time is always characterized by great instability and, as Yeats said, the loosening upon the world of mere anarchy. In other words, when the center does not hold, forces of the human psyche that before were contained by a central symbol or a central cohesive value that knitted a society together begin to emerge. The psychopath is such a force. Because we are in such a time of instability, the psychopathic spirit is emerging along with other dark powers. And a characteristic of such times, again, according to Jung, if you've read his book Ion, he goes into this at length. Yes? We have no dominance anymore. That's D-O-M-I-N-A-T-S. Dominant values. They are in the future. Our values are shifting. Everything loses its certainty. And let me add that I welcome comments and questions throughout the talk. I don't want this just to be a monologue. So, Jung in his book Ion describes the time of the birth of Christ as the beginning of and the end of a millennium, and also the beginning of the first century AD was the end of a millennium, and now we are at the end of a millennium. And the characteristics of those times are a loosening of the center, where heresies abound, where anarchy becomes more prevalent. And it's also a time where the need to go deeper into a study of our own human nature becomes more paramount. Apparently, the heresies that emerged in the first century AD were trying to do that. For example, branches of Gnosticism were more concerned with our psychology than they were with institutionalized forms of religion. But as always, such research going into the individual and valuing the individual over the institution threatens society, and so reactionary forces begin to come into play, and so you get this increasing tension between the needs of the individual and the needs of the collective to hold together, and both rise at the same time, creating incredible tension, which I think we're all feeling today. Now, that's the background of my talk, that my own need to investigate the psychopath and bring it to you arises out of a largely felt need today to go more deeply into the human psyche, perhaps with a view of finding the healing factor within. What can be done about it? What sort of healing can be brought to this disintegration that appears to be happening? It's nice to get attended to. The image of the psychopath that I want to explore is the image of the psychopath as a destroyer of social structure. That's where we're meeting him more prevalently today. And the most popular images of the psychopath as a destroyer of social structures is most easily visible in the psychopathic personalities that are emerging, for example, when the Iron Curtain came down and we saw what terrible devastation happened to some of the countries in Eastern Europe when the psychopathic personality gained a position of prominence in the governmental structure. You know, Ceausescu might be a good example. If allowed to rise into a position of prominence politically, the psychopathic personality can literally destroy a society. Hitler is another example. There are many, many examples. We don't have to go to Europe, poor old Europe. We can come much closer to home, of course, to see an increasing interest in this phenomenon. In our own national politics, we're beginning to see what happens when psychopathic personalities get into positions of power. They wreak terrible damage. We know about the SNL crisis, for example, with people in positions of power manipulating other people's money. We see it in the stock exchange as well, where people use other people's money for their own gains without any apparent consideration of what suffering that might cause or where the money might have come from. So the effect that we're feeling, we're feeling the effect of that psychopathic action even in our own society. Of course, we have the images of criminal psychopathy with the outlaws gaining more and more prominence. For example, with those programs that are coming out, the news programs like they're a bit sensationalistic. Yes, Current Affair, which are focusing a lot on the mass murderers and the popular term, the sociopath today. Most wanted, yeah. Our mass media is becoming gripped. We are becoming gripped by the image of the psychopath as destroyer of society. You can witness that in the proliferation of movies that are dealing with this phenomenon. So we're gripped with fascination and horror by the phenomenon. And that alone, I think, warrants investigation. Now, the next point I want to make in relation to my introduction here is that the psychopathic personality that we are familiar with, at least in the public media, does not arise or get to a position of power or prominence in a vacuum. There is a connection between the psychopathic personality who gets into the position of power and each of us who put him there. That connection is a hidden connection. Or to look at it psychologically, that connection is a connection based on unconsciousness. And I just want to tease that out a little bit. Why is it, for example, that we almost never can identify the psychopath in status nascendi, meaning in the early stages of his ascension? Why do we almost always miss the psychopathy? Why instead are we taken in by his charm, his persuasiveness, his uncanny ability to intuit our needs, and his ability to offer painless solutions to those needs? A recent program I saw on primetime, which illustrated these features of the psychopath, where the televangelists were exposed. Did anyone see that program, primetime? Very, very exposing program, which showed how millions of people were simply exploited for one person's selfish gains. To me, that was a very good example of psychopathic action at work, and those people... I hope no one here was included in that group, but it must be painful if you are caught like that. We've all been caught at some time or another, and I certainly include myself. But in the beginning, we're always taken in by the seductive qualities of the psychopath, and it's not until the psychopathic action begins to make itself felt socially that we begin to take action. Now, that missing or that inability in us to notice psychopathic possibilities in a person while they're ascending into power points out, this is the thesis of my talk tonight, points out a relationship based on unconsciousness. My proposal to you tonight is the reason we miss that, the reason that we're unconscious of that, is because we're unconscious of the same feature within ourselves, within each of us. Now that quality, that psychopathic quality within each of us may never assume full-blown proportions, and probably never will, full-blown proportions of a psychopathic personality, but it's a small hole or darkness in each of us that allows such a personality to arise to a position of prominence. So I want to make a yes. Hello, yes. Yes, rather than have to work with painful decisions, I think you meant, didn't you? Rather than having painful solutions? Yes, yourself, yeah. Yes. Oh, yes, yes. She was asking that, she was saying that it was easier to allow the psychopathic personality to offer painless solutions than it is to work on the painful solutions. So any politician who gets up and offers painful solutions is going to fail. I think she was making that point. So what I want to distinguish for you tonight is the psychopathic personality, who we're all familiar with, at least through the media, and the psychopath within, which is a quality within each of us that lies dormant or hidden, but which is a doorway to the emergence or a gateway to the psychopathic personality, who uses that to gain ascendancy in a society. That's my thesis. And furthermore, while we focus exclusively on the psychopathic personality and adopt apotropaic means of getting rid of them, which is another way of saying that we adopt methods of dealing with the psychopath that have to do with expunging or expelling the psychopath, and then we feel temporarily rid of him. Now, while we have to do that, I certainly support that. That is not a solution to the problem of the psychopath as a phenomenon in society, because while the focus is exclusively on the psychopathic personality, we miss how the psychopath within functions within each of us. And it doesn't function in a full-blown way like the psychopathic personality, but it functions in what I call, and this is my third concept for tonight, it occurs in psychopathic moments. So let me write those three things up. Psychopathic personality, the psychopath within, and the psychopathic moment. I'll be saying more about the psychopathic moment, but the psychopathic moment is a moment of psychopathy that occurs during the course of a day in the most banal interactions with our fellow human beings or our fellow members of society. During the course of a day, each of us can and does engage in what I call a psychopathic moment, and I'll tease out what that means. And while our focus exclusively goes onto the psychopathic personality, we miss those moments. And what that means, the implication of that is that the psychopath goes on functioning unabatedly and continuing to do his work of destroying a society. So the destruction of a society does not merely rest on the shoulders, as it were, of whatever psychopathic personality gains ascendancy. It's my contention that the destruction of a social system is just as likely through the millions of little psychopathic actions that occur every day in each of us. And that's where my attention is going to tonight. Tonight I want to focus on not the psychopathic personality, but the psychopath within each of us. The questions I want to ask are, how do we recognize the psychopath within at all? How do we discover how he functions in us at all? More deeply, if we get to that point of recognizing at least cognitively, that he does function, or perhaps in a feeling way that he does function within each of us, how do we, is there a process or a method that can help us identify the psychopath functioning within us in the moment of, in the psychopathic moment? That's the second question. So there's two parts to the talk tonight. One is, the first part is, how do we recognize the psychopath within it all? How do we do that? As an object, you might say. The second part, in which I'll be using the story of Milarepa as a paradigmatic example of a method, how do we, is there a process or a method in which the psychopathic energy, which is, if left unchecked or unconscious, will be an agent for the destruction of our society, how can that energy be channeled towards consciousness? Is there a method by which that energy can be, the psychopathic energy can be channeled towards consciousness to the point that an individual can recognize his or her own psychopathic moments? Very, very difficult work, but I want to attempt to describe to you how it can be done. First of all, let's, the first part of the paper, we'll go through till about 8:30, 8:40, something like that. And as I said, please interrupt with your questions as we go along. I don't want to lose anybody if I get too much into the monologue. Broadly speaking, the first part now is how do we recognize the psychopath within at all? So to start that, let me give you a description of the psychopathic personality, one that's generally agreed to amongst professionals, experts, whatever, people. I've written them up on the board. The first one is, the psychopathic personality is a person who breaks laws, conventions, ethical codes. The second point is that the psychopathic personality exhibits qualities of ruthlessness and has no concern for the suffering of others. The third quality, he is manipulative. He cons people. He can parody or imitate real feeling, but doesn't seem to have it. Can be very convincing, persuasive, charming. The fourth quality is that the psychopathic personality seems to be incorrigible, and that is to say, can't be changed. Now, if you look at those qualities, as I looked at them, something struck me about them. That is, the four qualities of the psychopath are qualities or are descriptions based on an absence of qualities. For example, the psychopath is absent of ethical qualities. The psychopath is absent of empathy or the ability to feel the suffering of others. The psychopath is absent of real feeling, and the psychopath is absent of the ability to develop. Now, this definition of the psychopath based on this absence is what makes the psychopath within so hard to get hold of, because it's a quality that depends on absence. In psychoanalytic jargon, they talk about a lacuna, kind of a barren state or a hole. And that's one of the reasons the psychopath within is so very hard to identify within yourself. It's that area often where you feel most confident or competent. And yet there's a hole there. And it's very hard to get hold of a hole or an absence. It's very hard to do that. And the psychopathic qualities come through that hole. So it's very, it's like a black hole, very dark place, an absence that you just can't get a hold of. Yes.
Could you elaborate perhaps on that area where you can
most harm yourself? Yes, it's the area where you can most fool yourself. You can most believe that you're doing something ethically correct when in fact you're being psychopathic. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. So the two comments were, one, you asked me to elaborate on that quality where you can feel most competent and yet that can be a lacuna. And the other question, the other comment was an elaboration on the idea that through the wound comes... Could you say it again? It's through the wound that the... Hello?
The area where you are strong.
Yeah.
The strength which you can give out in that area can also open for the opposite of
it. Oh, yes. Okay.
So the...
So one can be as vulnerable at the point where one feels most strong. Yes. Now, the next point I want to make as far as recognizing the psychopath within, I want to draw out for you the connection between the psychopathic personality who gains prominence in society and the individuals in the society. I want to tease out that connection for you with an example so that at least intellectually we can get the connection. That's the first step towards... One of the first steps towards discovering it within oneself is getting an intellectual connection. So I'll do that by means of an example. And the example I want to give is not of an individual so much who has gained prominence in the society as a psychopath, but an institution. And the institution I've chosen is the CIA. The CIA is the dark arm of the government, and we... lay people know very little about how the CIA really functions, but we know an awful lot about the popular image of the CIA. And it's that popular image that I want to address. The real CIA remains, for most of us here, an unknown quantity, but I would say there are probably some very important distinctions to make between the real people in the CIA and our popular image of the CIA. So the psychopathic qualities that I'm going to describe here pertaining to the CIA is to that popular image of the CIA, all right? Because it's that popular image that we are gripped by. It's the one that appears on the movies and in the millions of books, you know, the fiction books about the CIA and spies and so on. It's that image which carries our projections. It's that image that we are assailed with every day that demonstrates the hidden connection between the psychopath within each of us and that institution, that image of the institution. So let me describe to you four popular, and I'm pretty sure you'll agree to them, four popular attributes of this CIA image. First of all, the CIA agent in this image uses other people's vulnerabilities for purposes of power. An example, and this I'm sure this does really happen, keeping secret files on politicians, on their personal files, so that when you need something from the politician, you hint that there's something on the file about them that they may not like. That's using people's vulnerabilities for the purposes of political power. The second description is that CIA agents often manipulate other people's feelings quite ruthlessly to achieve their own ends. A common example is James Bond movies where two spies from different countries fall in love and then proceed to use each other's feelings to achieve their ends, their own ends, hurting each other a lot in the process. Let me know if any of these are not specific enough for you, and I'll fill them out. The third quality of the CIA in this image is that authenticity or integrity is often parodied and exploited. An example that you see on TV is, for example, at a congressional hearing where an agent will get up there and lie bald-facedly to the congressional committee, and then 6 months later, you learn that they lied through their teeth, and they say, "Yes, I lied through my teeth." The fourth one, the pursuit of knowledge exclusively for the purposes of power. For example, the CIA image as a network gathering information in dark corners throughout the world, which they channel back to the central place in, was it Vermont or Virginia? Somewhere where they use them for these nefarious purposes. Okay, so they're the four qualities that are attributed to the popular image of the CIA. So now, what I've done with those qualities is apply them to each of us as individuals. I applied them to myself. And see if you too can identify any of these qualities, either from the point of view that, yes, you have engaged in these actions, or you've been a victim of these actions from another individual. The first one I gave of the CIA was that it uses other people's vulnerabilities for purposes of power. In intimate relationships, how many of us have shared our deepest secret with our partner, and then a year later a conflict erupts between us, and then you find that information was used by your partner or by you to achieve a political end, namely control of the conflict? Who's experienced that one way or another? I won't ask you which way. Doesn't matter.
Both,
of course, yeah. Point two, the CIA, I described the agent as manipulating feelings ruthlessly to achieve political ends. In your work, place of work, how many times have clever manipulative words been used to manipulate somebody or some situation in order to advance yourself politically? A crass example is the director's couch in Hollywood. But I'm sure each of us can enumerate examples at our own workplace where such feelings have been manipulated ruthlessly to advance somebody, yourself, or somebody else. Point three. The CIA agent is described as parodying and or imitating authenticity, smilingly lying. Well, that's a very good example in my line of work. Therapy. How many times in therapy does a therapist mimic empathy with somebody with whose issue you can't identify with at all? But you don't want to lose the client, or you don't want to own up to your ignorance. That's a very, I can own up to that. It's very easy to do because the power relationship is so unequal. It's very easy to mimic empathy and get away with it, when in fact you can't relate to the issue at all. But that's not relegated just to therapy, to my profession. That can happen anywhere, and does. How many times, for example, does empathy get mimicked for the sake of pacifying the other person? The fourth way I describe the CIA, that it pursues knowledge for the purpose of power or self-aggrandizement. Examples in our everyday life, one I thought of was with research, the pursuit of using subjects for research. Now, in Hitler's Germany, Nazi doctors, that's a very crass example of how knowledge was pursued for the purposes of political power, causing great suffering to many people. But you don't have to go to Nazi Germany. There was a famous experiment called the Millikan experiment in the United States, I think in the 50s or 60s. Do you know something like that? Yeah, it was a very famous, well-known experiment because it pointed out the lack of ethics in the experiment. The experiment briefly was unknowing subjects, were placed on one side of a screen, and an actor was placed on the other side of the screen, and the experimenter was with the subject, and by methods of persuasion and charm and what have you, persuaded the subject to press a button, at which point the actor would would pretend that he'd received an electric shock. And the object of the experiment was to see how far the subject would go. And that raised a huge storm, because afterwards, the subjects, when they realized what they'd done, you know, that they'd been shocking, they thought they'd been shocking an innocent victim. Many of them had severe emotional reactions after the experiment. And the ethics of the experimenter was called into question. And to me, that's a very good example of how research can be used, or the pursuit of knowledge can be used at the expense of people or animals or other subjects. So does that give you an example of, at least intellectually, of how the popular images of psychopathy in society are a carrier projection or of our own individual qualities that we almost never see? Does that point out to you the connection, at least intellectually, between our own psychopathic moments and the full-blown version that we see so readily? Are there any questions about that before I move on? Yes.
Maybe it's weak on the definition of psychopath, but when you seem to say it was an indication of psychopathy to pacify someone, like a feigned that is part of the definition.
No, thanks for the question.
Good manners, or
it could be, yes. Yes, the question is, would trying to pacify somebody by mimicking empathy, would that denote psychopathy? The answer is no, unless a certain condition prevails. That what marks any action as psychopathic is the absence of relatedness to what you're doing. So in other words, if you imitate empathy in order to pacify the other person, but you know the relationship implications of that, and you know that it's an ethically problematic situation, then that's not psychopathic. It is psychopathic if there's no relatedness. In other words, if there's absence in you at the moment of what this might do to the other person, what it might do to you and your own feelings of integrity.
For example, you do it so you can leave, but you know you're a phony, but you're not a psychopath. You do it because
Well, if you do it without any kind of ethical implication or any feeling implication, it's the absence of those qualities that denotes the psychopathy. Yes. Well, I think the question is, would this condition be intensified in a dysfunctional family? What? Not more prevalent, no. More visible, yes. I can broaden the question when a society becomes dysfunctional, psychopathic action becomes more visible because the center's breaking down. And as I said before, the dark hidden powers that were kept in check by a coherence within the society begin to emerge. Rick.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking that as an example of what you were talking about, the authenticity and imitating real feeling happens quite often, at least the way I see it, between adults and children, where real concern is often mimicked. And I think lots of times, at least what I've seen, there's this attitude, well, the child will never even know, or if they do know, they'll never remember, or somehow the awareness of the child is diminished. I think that in my own life, I can see myself as using that as a rationalization, not really owning up to this.
The question is concerning the emergence of psychopathic moments in parent-child interactions, where feelings are often imitated towards the child. Again, I would qualify that by saying it becomes, in my definition, a psychopathic moment when there's an absence of relatedness, or in the adult who's imitating the feeling. Yes, one more question, then I think we should move on. The question is a 2-week seminar in which I'm asked to compare and contrast the psychopathic personality with the narcissistic personality. In brief, let me say you've hit it very close to the mark as far as I'm concerned. That I think there is a very strong connection between the two syndromes, insofar as I believe that the genesis of the psychopath within is the narcissistic wound. That's the one I'm talking about. One of my sadnesses about tonight is that I didn't have time to explore with you and fill out for you what I'm talking about when I talk about the psychopath within more fully in terms of its genesis. You know, what psychological conditions today are actually creating the psychopath and his emergence. So that's a very germane question. That's as far as I can go with it right now, though. Okay, I should move on, I think. And now, we have the intellectual connection. Let me go a little bit further. How we can come to recognize the psychopath within a little more closer to home. And, of course, dreams are an excellent vehicle for this. So my next part is I want to just tell you some dreams that for the dreamer or the dreamers involved here in these examples did start to bring the quality of the psychopath closer to home, more than just an intellectual discourse will do. The first dream is this. I go to see Max in a small room to talk. As we talk, the room tilts, and it seems we are on a ship going down and can't get off. A man prevents us from jumping. It becomes a train going somewhere. I throw this man off, and he hits the ground, smashing his legs and hips. He throws something at me, screaming, "Look what you have done." He wants consciousness. But I go to him with a gun and I twist it to his mouth and fire. But the gun clicks. This man goes to an old-fashioned prison where he becomes mad, I think. One day another prisoner kills him. Then this second prisoner is subjected to the most horrible, I'd put now, psychopathic assault by a fat guard. If anyone saw the Midnight Express, you'd know what I mean, that film, Midnight Express. And as I, with a file of other people, watch fascinated yet horrified, the guard gives him vicious, accurate, methodical blows to the ribs, groin, and the belly. There's no hope against such a guard. we all file out. End of dream. Next dream. My girlfriend and I are with a fat politician. We're having a toast. While he isn't looking, my girlfriend surreptitiously slips some poison into his drink, and we smile as we toast while he drinks his last drink. We're going to pause while Carl diddles around. Okay. Now, those two dreams definitely show the presence of the psychopath. I think that's easily recognizable. And yet, in telling those dreams, the dreamer can often have no relationship to the dream. Hence, the hidden psychopath begins to get revealed. There can be a dream like the second one, for example, can be told with no feeling, no shock, no, you know, no sense of doing something wrong. Just there's a dream, and that demonstrates in situ the presence of the psychopath within. I've had, for example, somebody tell me very smilingly and calmly, without any feeling at all, a very common thing that I think you'll recognize, talking about how his wife and he intend to spend her mother's inheritance, where they're going to put the money. It was all spent except for one problem. She wasn't dead. I mean, when I hear something like that, I sort of go into shudders, and my imaginal faculty goes into override. But for him, what about in the office where the boss says, well, I've got to get rid of Joe. He's not doing a good job. Now, that need not be psychopathic, but it gets close to a psychopathic moment when there's absolutely no sense that Joe might have some investment in his job, that he might have a family to support. So it's not just the mere saying, I've got to get rid of this person. It's how it's said. When it's said with that, the absence of those qualities. Very common moments. But even having dreams like that need not bring the matter home, but the psyche can press the point. Here's a couple of dreams that press the point. They press the point in the sense that the dreamer, once he had those dreams, started bringing the results over into his waking life. This is a dream of terrifying coldness and implacability. I'm at home, the dreamer says. I invite some friends to come, but when they come, I'm unable to talk. I push them away. They are puzzled, concerned, but continue anyway. I, however, retreat to the bedroom, where I'm suddenly overcome with fear at a presence outside. A bitterly cold, icy wind, frosty, blows in the window and nearly paralyzes me to the bone. It cuts through everything. With all my courage, I close the window. Next, I try to go for help, to explain, to say something, but I stumble, I can't. I'm in an alleyway. The drama, the tension increases. There are sudden autonomous events that begin to happen, and yet they're related to me in some way. A bus driver suddenly turns around and drives off. I feel a rising panic. A huge tractor creature rolls across my car, crushing it, and then starts lumbering after me. I run back to the house. I panic. My terror overcomes me. I collapse on the ground, face down, whimpering, and the machine rumbles near me and stops. If you could imagine one of those dinosaur cars at the track, the speedster track with those huge wheels sort of lumbering next to you. I feel the ground shaking, and I'm whimpering in terror like a small baby. My pitiful attempts to change things were useless. It is implacable, that is, incorrigible. That's an image of psychopathic force that's gone beyond personification. It's like an experience of psychopathic force which is unreceptive to attempts to change. It's impersonal, inhuman. So that's a more impactful experience of the psychopathic quality. It was nightmarish, and the dreamer woke up and began to be changed. Instead of trying to change it, the dreamer started to be changed by the inexorable knowledge of an unchangeable force within the psyche. So he started to change. That's one of the values of psychopathic action within the psyche. Next dream. Gandhi speaks to a crowd and assures them that he has no private gain from his work. They applaud. A remorseless, vicious psychopath kills Gandhi, and I, the dreamer, am to jail him. He is a psychopath, and I can find no help. The jail is hopelessly inadequate. The locks keep breaking off spontaneously. He escapes, and I try again, getting more and more frustrated. The crowd whispers that he's better off dead. I get enraged, and finding an axe, I charge after him. So there you can see that dream is demonstrative in the sense that it begins to distinguish the intentions of the psyche from social intentions. Like the dreamer is identified with social intentions, that is, you lock up the psychopath. But the spontaneous breaking of the locks indicates that the psyche has a different intentionality. And so that's where psychic intention and social intention begin to diverge concerning the psychopath. And once the psyche's intentions were starting to be observed, namely the psychopath was free, you could start to see the dreamer begin to change and become more psychopathic. Whereas before, the dreamer had identified with that ideal figure of Gandhi who gets no private gain from his work. What an idealization. So part of the intentionality of the psyche in this dream seemed to be to destroy a certain idealization, which of course produces the enantiodromia, you know, the opposite coming in. So the psychopath and the ideal figure are very related, and that gets back to your question on narcissism. The psychopath is related to the idealization that can occur in narcissism. Now, all of these dreams show the psychopath within, the presence of the psychopath within, and also the proximity of the dreamer to the psychopath. But even having dreams and working with them that way is not enough to bring the consciousness necessary to identify a psychopathic moment as it occurs. But it is a start. But the next part of my talk is I want to describe to you in general terms what kind of method can be invoked that can do more than just recognize the psychopath as a force within, but different somehow from oneself. How we can go past that to actually channeling the psychopathic energy towards individuation. How the psychopath, as I put in the brochure, how the psychopath can move from an agent of destruction of society to an agent of individuation of the individual. That's the question I want to pursue in the second half of our talk tonight. How the psychopathic energy can be an agent of transformation of the personality instead of an unconscious agent for the destruction of a social system. It's very difficult work. It's a method fraught with danger, but I want to attempt to articulate it to you, and I'll explain why in the second half of the talk. I think it's a fairly... The method is so difficult that I think it represents only a slim hope for us in these dark times. But it's enough for me to continue that Jung said, the fate of the world hangs on a thread, and that thread is the psyche. That's enough for me to try to understand a method based on knowledge of the psyche that can change the psychopathic spirit from an unconscious agent of destruction to an agent of transformation. And I'd like to bring you along with me tonight into that method. For now, though, we'll have a few questions, and then we'll have a short break. The question is this related to the trickster as an agent of transformation? They certainly both can function as agents of transformation. They function differently, though. For although the psychopath tricks, he is substantially different from the trickster, because the trickster, always the goal of the trickster, is always revelation of the self. But the psychopath tricks for his own selfish gain. So to utilize that power towards individuation is much more difficult than anything else, I think. It's a method of last resort. It can go wrong so much because you can get caught by it so easily. There was a film I saw recently, All the King's Men. It was a film in the 1940s based on Chicago politics. And his rationale, the politician's rationale for mixing with corruption and evil, was that good comes out of evil. Now, that's a profound psychological law, but it's a banality when the ego identifies with it. I mean, he was just caught by it, and so he was destroyed by evil. It's very Faustian, even getting close to that spirit, one can get caught by it. So to imagine that one can work with it and have it be an agent for one's transformation is fraught with danger. And I want to speak to that later. Carl. Yes, the question is, or the statement is, that we are becoming more and more immune to evidence of psychopathic action. For example, when the president clearly exhibits fraudulent behavior and there's not a blink of the eye. And I would agree with that, which tells me that he's gaining ascendancy in each of us. If we're becoming more immune to it, then he's gaining ascendancy in dark, hidden ways. Yes, Nancy. Well, the shadow is a very broad name that Jung used to capture all those psychic events that are repressed by consciousness. So that would include the psychopath within, but would also include positive qualities, or tricksterish qualities, or qualities of the self, or contrasexual qualities. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, the question is, or the statement is, that what's common to the qualities is the lack of that would denote the qualities as psychopathic is the lack of relatedness. Yes, that's the broad way of saying it, Sally. Yeah. Carl.
You know the Iliad?
Yes.
The wrath of Achilles. He won't fight because they took his girl away.
Mm-hmm.
Not till his friend kills. Then there's the Iliad. But I don't think this is anything new. It's been going on since
David. Yes. You think Achilles' action was psychopathic? In what way?
All these guys were being killed. He stabbed.
The question is relating to the history of psychopathic qualities and the Iliad, where Achilles is described as psychopathic. to be psychopathic in the way that I'd understand it, Achilles would have to have no kind of notion or sense that other people were suffering from his decision. Okay. 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 Yes.
I'm just a little weary of saying we're going more into it or something because I think it's
definitely. All right. So the comment is that our history shows the presence of the psychopath in abundance. That this era is not necessarily unique.
Well, I don't want to feel special.
Special, right.
A little backer than everyone else.
Okay. Right, we're not special. One more question, then I'd like to have quite a short break, if you don't mind, say 5 minutes. Is there any one more question? Yes. No, I don't think so. The image of movement counterclockwise is an image used to denote a process that is going against the normal flow of time or the normal flow of life. So it's in alchemical terms they would call that an opus contra naturum. It's any kind of work that goes against the grain of nature or against the natural flow, and that would not necessarily be psychopathic at all. There's many cultural images that have that image contained in them. In psychological terms, you would say that is movement into the unconscious. All right, let's have a very short break of 5 minutes. The second part of our talk is, as I've said, I'll try and delineate for you a method, and it is a method of last resort because it does involve such a destructive power, a method by which the psychopath within can be channeled away from being an unconscious agent of destruction externally to an agent of individuation. The story I want to tell you to illustrate the method is the story of Milarepa, who is a 12th century Buddhist saint. It's very apropos that the story comes from Buddhism, because the Buddhism, in my understanding as a layperson, is a psychological method par excellence of how to channel destructive energies towards spiritual goals. His name is Milarepa, Milarepa. The first part of the name Mila means good news, and Repa has to do with the cotton clothes that he wore when he was practicing his meditation. Milarepa turned out to be an exemplary teacher of Buddhism, a master, perhaps the greatest master, and his method concerns itself with attaining Buddhism within the span of one lifetime. So it's an extreme method. I believe there's a school of Buddhism in Massachusetts that's focusing on Milarepa's teachings. He did not begin as a Buddhist saint. He began, well, let me tell you the story. The story of Milarepa is paradigmatic of the way to Buddhahood in the span of one lifetime. It's a story of profound transformation of a young man in 12th century Tibet. It describes in Buddhist terms some central aspects of the process of transformation in the individual utilizing the dark destructive power of the psychopath. He was born in the 12th century. Up to the age 7, he was the son of wealthy parents and enjoyed all of the benefits of that wealth can bring. When he was 7, however, his father died, and the estates and the wealth were given over to his uncle in custody until Milarepa attained the age of majority. However, his uncle was the opposite of his father. He was a tyrannical despot, and he appropriated all of the wealth to his own family and left Milarepa and his mother destitute. Although they lived on the same land, they were treated no more than servants. So they lived in poverty and suffering. But Milarepa's mother put up with this oppression in the belief that when he was 15, the wealth would be returned. So when he was 15, she called all the villagers together who had witnessed the will of her husband, and then asked the uncle to turn the wealth over to her and Milarepa. He refused. If he didn't refuse, we wouldn't have a story. He refused and said to her, make war on us if you are many, make spells on us if you are few. So he threw her out of the house, threw Milarepa out of the house, and they were left destitute, farming on a small piece of land that belonged to her side of the family. Well, as so often happens with the feminine, Milarepa's mother became a vengeful, merciless woman who saw her young son as an instrument of her darkest desires, which were to utterly destroy her oppressors. That is no moral judgment on the feminine. That's simply a comment on nature. We can see that today with the oppression of feminine nature, that how the enraged goddess is emerging, who simply wants to destroy those who have oppressed her. Milarepa at that time thought nothing more about his life and his own direction than to make his mother happy, to please his mum. So when she sent him off to a black magician who were plentiful in the Bon religion around that time, he trotted off, and it's a testimony to his genius that he proved to be an excellent student of black magic, casting spells at a distance. So one day, a servant at his uncle's house saw to his astonishment one day. It was a day where the uncle had invited about 35 people to a big party, and the servant looked out of the house and saw in the yard a huge scorpion. It must have been a vision of some kind, shaking the pillars of the house. And at that point, the stallions began to mount the mares, who kicked the stallions, and that furore brought down the pillars of the house and destroyed many, killed many people, and destroyed the wealth of the family. Milarepa's mother was very keen to have them know who did it. It was her son, of whom she could be finally proud. And when the villagers threatened her, she ordered Milarepa to do more black magic, and he did. He destroyed the crops, all the crops in the village, with a rainstorm. Now, it's important in the story to get Milarepa's attitude, because it was psychopathic, that he didn't think about his own actions at all beyond wanting to please his mother. He had no personal relationship to his actions at all. He was, if you like, split off. It was a narcissistic kind of condition, I think, where he was split off into kind of a maladapted personality that only wanted to please mother. and do good with mother, and he had no personal relationship to those dreadful actions of black magic. However, once he had done those actions, Milarepa changed, because being a Buddhist, being in the Buddhist country, he knew about the law of karma. So he understood that in future lifetimes all of this black magic would be turned against him. Now, he didn't exactly feel moral. He became terrified, which perhaps fear is the beginning of morality. Fear of punishment in Kohlberg's scheme of development of ethics. That's the first one, first level of ethics, fear of punishment. But it was the law of karma which gave Milarepa an experience of terror about his own actions, and that began to move him, you might say, into relationship to his actions, out of the lacuna or the hole of psychopathy. And what he did was he started to run around looking for a teacher who could help him purify himself of his karmic actions. So eventually he found Marpa, M-A-R-P-A, Marpa, who was a master of Buddhism, and Marpa accepted Milarepa as a student based on some dreams he and his wife had, which showed convincingly that once cleansed of his sins, Milarepa's renown would ring throughout the universe and he would become a great teacher of Buddhism. It's the purging of his sins that is the method. Marpa knew that Milarepa was endowed with a great capacity which so far had been used only in the service of his mother to do murder and great harm. The process of transforming Milarepa from that black magician to a Buddhist saint began with Marpa engaging in what appear to be psychopathic actions against Milarepa. So Milarepa came to Marpa in a total surrender. He had nowhere else to go. This is why it's a method of last resort. The individual has nowhere else to go. So he finds a teacher, and Marpa subjected Milarepa to terrible ordeals that shocked his wife, his other students, and certainly shocked Milarepa. But because Milarepa had nowhere else to go, he kept coming back, because he also loved Marpa, and there was a karmic bond between the two. For example, he would tell Milarepa to build a tower with utter sincerity, and then when he had built the tower, which took years of work, Marpa would come to him and say, what have you done this for? What a waste of time. And Milarepa would say, but you told me to do it. And Marpa would say, I did not. You're a liar. Take down these stones and put them back in place. Everyone. So Milarepa would do it. Then Milarepa would come and give Marpa gifts, like a bag of barley, hard won, or a copper pot. And Marpa would kick him and throw him out of the house, saying, don't you dare dirty my floor with your presence. Get out. He would appear to Milarepa. When Milarepa had finished, he had to build four towers. when he finished one tower, Marpa came to him and said, I didn't tell you to do this. Or he would say, well, I must have been drunk. I didn't mean it. I don't want you to build this tower. Take it down. He beat, slapped, and threw Milarepa out of his house time and time again. Now these, in quotes, psychopathic actions, brought Milarepa to the brink of suicide. And when he was at that point, Marpa revealed the true purpose of his actions. He told him his dreams. He told him his wife's dreams. And Milarepa was restored to Marpa as a student with the highest honors. And he was taken from that absolute bottom place to being a student where Marpa freely transmitted Buddhist wisdom to him. And Milarepa retired to the hills to finish his study, and the power for destruction that Milarepa exhibited now became the fire of bliss, the kundalini or the tummo energy, which supported him and burned up obstacles to his own enlightenment. So the psychopathic energy was changed during that process from Milarepa being an unconscious black magician or psychopath to an energy that, instead of destroying other people, destroyed obstacles to his enlightenment. And that's the great method in Buddhism. And he emerged years later as the greatest teacher of Buddhism. A harsh method. And one, how on earth would you understand that? If you read that as a Buddhist initiation, how could you understand the actions of Marpa the teacher? Well, that's what we'll try and do here. What Marpa did was use Milarepa's own powers that had been turned towards darkness against Milarepa's personality. So the psychopathic energy was used to smash the old maladaptive personality and to create a new personality, which always brings in the question of suicide. That is, the person taking the psychological process literally. Yes? The psychopathic energy was channeled by a master from an agent of destruction of other people or social institutions to an agent in which a maladaptive personality or a neurotic personality was smashed, which freed up which could allow a new personality to come through. But that always brings in suicide question. Because when your personality is in the process of being smashed, you think you're dying. So it's a method that induces a crisis. That's the story of Milarepa, very briefly. Are there any questions or elaborations on the story? Yes.
Just so I don't want to presume too much to make sure I understand the story, the teacher, Marco, was consciously using this method.
Yes.
Even though it was cruel and harsh, he
knew what he was
doing.
Yes. Yes.
So we can allow, I guess, some tolerance or whatever for his using that negative energy, the way lying to the student or the building power that I didn't know.
Well, if you didn't understand, the question is, can we develop tolerance towards Marpa and his, in quote, psychopathic action towards his student on the basis that he was using that power consciously? I think that the answer to that is yes. How you could tell that from the outside, you couldn't. You'd have to know the inside story. From the outside, it would look like psychopathic action, and you'd say, how terrible. You'd have to know something about the interior dynamics in order to evaluate the situation. So in the story, even the other students were utterly dumbfounded. They'd never seen Marpa act this way before. And his wife tried to rescue or mother Milarepa. And in fact, her attempts to do that interfered with Milarepa's attaining complete enlightenment. But on the other hand, her actions made him into a bodhisattva, you might say, the one who must remain on earth to teach others. So the action of the mother is crucial too to keeping him connected to the earth. Yes?
Speaking of failing to see psychopathic characteristics, I realized that when I read the story of Milarepa, since reading it, I forgot so much of the indignities that he was subjected to that you were telling. I was doubting whether it was really
the same story. The question concerns the story of Milarepa, where he read the story and had forgotten about those psychopathic moments. They are indeed there. Yes. Well, the first intimation was his understanding the law. The question is, what brought consciousness to Milarepa concerning his own psychopathic actions? The answer is, the first intimation he got was through the understanding of the law of karma, which told him that his own actions would be visited upon him in future lifetimes. That terrified him. And it's that terror which starts to bring you into relationship to your own actions and what you've done.
But where was that consciousness before he did the action? I mean, it's like all of a sudden...
Split off? Yeah, split off.
Split off.
Yeah. The question was, where was that understanding of karma before? And one answer is that it split off. Yes. The question is there a method like that today going on, being used today in therapy? I will get to that question a little later. Okay, in the next few minutes. Let me move on to outlining for you the conditions that are illustrated in the story, the conditions that are necessary for this method to be used. They're very specific and ought not, in my opinion, be used under any other conditions. And I'll also say used by whom. Now, in the story, there are more than these conditions, but these are the three main ones that I want to bring out tonight. The first condition is that in the individual, like Milarepa, although he has a, what you might say, a neurotic personality, that underlying that neurotic personality is a dormant personality that is creative. That's the first condition, that underneath the neurotic personality or the maladaptive persona is a dormant creative personality that so has not seen the light of day. He did, of course, because when it emerged, he became the greatest teacher of Buddhism. That was the dormant underlying personality. The second condition, illustrated in Milarepa, is that the foundations, the psychic foundations, are very strong. That, in other words, that the psychic foundations within the individual supporting consciousness are very strong. When Marpa had his dreams about Milarepa, they were dreams involving images of the Vajra and the stupa, which are supreme images in Buddhist iconography. The Vajra is the thunderbolt, which removes all obstacles and yet is in itself indestructible. And the stupa, of course, is the Buddhist temple. Those images came up in his dream in relationship to Milarepa, the coming student. Now, they're supreme images, which showed that the foundations of within Milarepa were very strong and very stable. And that stability and that strength is needed, because when the personality breaks down, you need to have very strong psychic foundations that can hold the individual together. Otherwise, you have a psychotic break. Now, in modern terms, you have a psychotic break instead of an initiation process. Now, in modern terms, you can get a sense of these foundational supports in dreams involving animal or vegetal powers, and I'll give you, or elemental powers that provide images of support to the personality, and I'll give some examples of those. But the third point that I want to discuss is that the action, the psychopathic action directed against Milarepa, was governed by a master, Marpa. In modern terms, we would say it's governed by the self, not by anybody's ego. Marpa is an image of the self. And there was a bond of love between Marpa and Milarepa that supported these actions. Milarepa sustainedly loved Marpa while he was going through this abuse. He could not give up loving Marpa. And Marpa could not give up loving Milarepa. Like when Milarepa left, he did abandon the relationship once or twice. And when Marpa had learned that his student had gone, he broke down and wept, which astounded everybody. He said, my son, my spiritual son, you know, he's leaving. So there was a deep, in their terms, there was a deep karmic bond between them. So that bond has to exist between the self and the ego. Then the ego can sustain the psychopathic action, which comes back directed against the maladjusted personality. Let me go... Oh, and the fourth point, which is the first point I wanted to make, is that the first condition, if you just go... The conditions I've outlined now are 2, 3, and 4, and the first one is his experience of fear and terror when he began to feel the effects of his own black magic through the karmic law. Now, what I want to do is go through each of these a little more in detail and relate them to modern terms that we can talk about. The first one is his experience of fear and terror through his understanding of the karmic law, which says, as you persecute, so you shall be the victim. How do we get to that today? Well, in masculine psychology, the role of the anima plays a prominent part here. And let me give you a dream that illustrates that. The dream is, I go down to a dimly lit wooden stage deep in a cave. There's water dripping, it's unsanitary conditions. A body, a woman, is lying on the planks with a foul, bloody gauze bandage over her body. There is life-saving apparatus around. I am to be the doctor. I go onto the platform and it looks like this young woman is dying, and the gauze is especially bloody below the waist. I gently pull the gauze down from her face. She is pale and dried blood is on her eyes. She's dazed and delirious. Now that is an image of sheer suffering, suffering unto dying. And when the dreamer had this dream and he was faced with this image of suffering which moved him greatly, but he was also faced with the moral imperative that he was to be the healer, but at the time he didn't know how to heal. So he didn't know how on earth he could be the healer to this condition. Now that concatenation of the experience of suffering plus the imperative to heal it produced suffering for him. He began to feel the suffering because he wanted to heal so much. He was moved by it so much and he wanted to heal, but he couldn't. So he began to suffer. And so her suffering became his. And of course, there's the psychological law that he who heals is also the one who wounds. So he was the one, the dreamer was the one who created that condition. In psychic law, you're asked to heal what you've wounded. So in other words, that's the karmic law in action right there. And the role of the anima in masculine psychology is pivotal to gaining this experience of suffering.
to bring one into relationship to one's psychopathic parts. Next point, the underlying dormant personality.
And that is the end of the tape. This is John Radecki, tape 2 of 2.
Then we can have a little discussion or questions if you want to fill any of them out. You ready? The second condition for this method that I said was that there's an underlying dormant creative personality that is sort of lying in wait to emerge. If that's not there, this method should not be attempted because you'll be destroying a neurosis, a neurotic personality that needs to be there. There are many people who go into therapy that only need to become conscious of how valuable their neurosis is. The question was, did I believe that psychotics ought to remain some psychotics ought to remain psychotics. I wasn't talking about psychotics at all. I was talking about neurotics. Many people, and I include myself during periods of my own development, where you need to hang on to your island of neurosis because that's all you've got. And to strip it away without having anything else there is a mistake. So now how do you intuit the existence of this dormant creative personality because it is hidden? Well, Marpa had dreams that indicated it, and so we can too. As a therapist, you can have dreams about your client which show that hidden personality. I have. And also the individual himself or herself can have such dreams that they don't know anything about, but which show that creative personality. I'll give you an example of some dreams that show this, that give hope for the difficult process to come. First dream: I am in the company of Jesus, Muhammad, and Buddha. I am to proclaim peace to the world. It's one dream. Next dream: I meet an experienced shamaness who tells me that we probably dream each other. Third dream: I am in a house that appears at first psychotic from the outside, but inside, in a bed, lies a young child sleeping, and he is about to wake up. Okay, those examples, brief examples. Let me move on to the third condition, that there has to be support, evidence of support from the deep psyche to the person, so that the psychic foundations are strong, so that the person can undergo the initiation in which the personality is temporarily dismantled for the sake of a more comprehensive personality emerging. That kind of transformative process, that initiatory process, has to be supported from deep within the psyche. So intuitions of this support come through a lot in animal dreams, vegetal dreams, elemental dreams. I'll give you some examples. Beg your pardon? I'll tell you. Dreams. The question is, what are elemental dreams? Dreams involving the elements. One example I'll give you right now: the dreamer and some other people are on the edge of a canyon, and there is a huge wind blowing. The dreamer is terrified about jumping off, so his woman friend, as women so often do in these matters, leads the way and jumps off. And so he jumps off too, and the wind comes up from below and supports them. And the animal. Vegetal dream. I'm in a forest. We are to scale a tree. I ask, is that the tree? Looking at a thin, wavering sapling. They laugh. And I laugh when I realize the absurdity of that proposition. I then look over my left shoulder and see a colossus, a huge fir tree, going up to the heavens. Next dream. There is a tortoise, and on his back is the world, and encircling the world is a serpent. The tortoise emerges from the waters at the same moment that the snake lifts his head. So the foundational support of the tortoise emerges at the point that the active principle, the serpent, begins to make its presence felt. So the snake is an image of the Kundalini, say. When that active process begins to take over, the foundational supports emerge at the same moment. Next animal dream. I walk into a cage of wild elephants. With a bellow, a large one grabs me in his trunk and lifts me out of danger as the others charge. He saves my life. An example where support is felt from the self to the ego, where the ego-self axis is experienced as a supportive, loving, nourishing one. A hand comes down from the sky and touches me on the shoulder. Next dream, I'm trying to go to the toilet, but too many people are around. Dr. Jung comes in and gently leads them out. One more dream of animal powers that are supportive. The dreamer experiences polar bears coming towards him. He quivers in fear, but the polar bears want to play with him. Another dream of the animal powers supporting the process. The dreamer is in the ocean with an anima figure. The dreamer is terrified because orca, the great killer whale, is coming up from underneath. But the anima figure breaks out into an expression of religious ecstasy as the whale breaks the surface and the dreamer sees the eyes of Osiris on the front of the whale. Very supportive dream. Now the whale is an image for the very dynamism of the psyche itself, and they're showing support. Here's a dream which shows danger. Don't go near this person with this kind of process. A young man, a bull in a field threatens me. I run away from him to the fence, which is a high tension fence, at which point I float off into the air. So that dream indicates that if he gets too close to his masculine power, or if that's pushed onto him too much, too quickly, he'll just dissociate, too much high tension. So you wouldn't engage a person like that in a process like this. Okay. Now, the fourth condition is that, as I said, is that the action of the apparent psychopathic energy is governed by the self. Marpa was the example in the story. Not, as I said, by anybody's ego, the analysts or any individual, because the chances of getting caught by the energy are too great. Now, what kind of process or what kind of method do we have where the individual's psychopathic energy can be mirrored back to him in a way that the old personality can be broken down, but at the same time the individual can be supported by a bond of love and compassion? Well, the analytic process, as described by Jung, is a method that will do that. The analytic process, in its direct form, the word analysis means tearing down, stripping down. In the analytic process, the dreamer often presents dreams that he can find no feeling or moral relationship to. The analytic process itself begins to tease apart the dream material, tear it apart in a quasi-unfeeling, uncaring way. You know, so if you present a dream, I'll give you an example. But let me go on to say the analytic process itself mirrors psychopathic qualities in that it's an unfeeling, in quotes, an amoral process of tearing down, teasing apart. But it's held by somebody who has a relationship of compassion to the dreamer, as Marpa did for Milarepa. So the dreamer, under those conditions, has his own psychopathy mirrored back to him in the analytic process. And if that analytic process is followed through in the correct manner, it becomes a tearing down of the old personality. Let me give an example of a dream in which, for the dreamer, could find no personal relationship to the dream image. It was a dream image of a woman in a circus with a breast and a penis coming out of the breast. But he could find no relationship to that dream, so it was kind of held psychopathically, you might say. So the process of analysis could begin with a question like, how do you imagine it would feel both to the woman and whoever was nursing at the breast? Well, that particular question, that analytic question, released tremendous energy in the dreamer. In other words, the energy that was locked up in that dream image got released through that analytic question. How would it feel to the dreamer to be at that breast, and how would it feel to the woman? Then the dreamer got in touch with the narcissism in the mother that seeks her own satisfaction through the baby, and leaving the baby in a state of neediness, where the baby's needs could not be satisfied with that kind of relationship. It was a way in which she was receiving sexual satisfaction, you might say, through the nourishment at the breast. So it's a very difficult dynamism, very hard to get at. But once the analytic process again, the question was asked very amorally, you might say, or unfeelingly, like it was an analytic question. What would be the experience of each party? But that's what released the dreamer into a relationship to the material and proceeded to break down the splits in his personality. And it releases tremendous energy. But the analyst has to be there with his compassion, you know, knowing, and wisdom, knowing what's going to happen if the analytic process is successful, that a breakdown in the personality, which is based on splits and denials and repressions, as that begins to break down and energy is released for the process of transformation, the analyst has to be there with compassion to hold that deep psychological process. It's a method that is, as I said, fraught with dangers, because naturally the analyst has to be very conscious of the process. As the Buddhists say, he has to be a master of wisdom and compassion, both, to know how to use quasi-psychopathic processes in the spirit of compassion. But under those circumstances, one can engage in a creative breakdown of the personality for the sake of the emergence of a dormant personality that's more creative and more comprehensive, able to contain the gifts of the individual, you might say. So I hope I've given you those four conditions, and I've tried to relate them from the story, the Buddhist point of view, to modern terms. And I hope I've at least given you a taste of what's possible today. So at that point, I'd like to bring my talk to a conclusion with two quotes. The first point is the condition of fear and terror, where dawn begins to dawn on one that one's actions may be directed against oneself. The second condition is that there is an underlying dormant creative personality. The third condition is that there is support from the deep psyche beyond consciousness, the animal and the vegetal and the elemental psyche. The fourth condition is that the action of the psychopathic energy against the maladaptive personality is governed by the self, not by anybody's ego. The two quotes that I want to give, one is from Jung and one is from Schwartz-Salant, speak to this issue of working on psychopathic energy in a broader perspective. Jung's quote relates to the story of Job, in which Job underwent suffering from you might say, a psychopathic aspect of the self. That's Jung's thesis in writing that book. He says, "The book of Job serves as a paradigm for a certain experience of God which has special significance for us today. It is far better to admit the effect, the affect, and to submit to its violence than to try to escape it. The point of the whole proceeding, the violence is meant to penetrate to a man's vitals." And I think he does mean a man. This seems to be a feature of masculine psychology. "And he to succumb to its action through, as I said, the role of the anima will help him do that. He must be affected by it, otherwise its full effect will not reach him. But he should know or learn to know what has affected him, namely the dark side of God. For in this way he transforms the blindness of the violence on the one hand and the affect on the other hand into knowledge, that is, self-knowledge." The next quote from Schwartz-Salant. "Jung stressed that the shadow and the opposing will is the necessary condition for all actualization. This means an individual lives with an acute awareness of his or her own dark nature, in which there is an alignment with a pull towards death. This dynamic includes psychopathic qualities that function without any moral sense. The shadow brings us closer to our ugliness, to aspects of our nature that may be beyond redemption." Okay, let's have a few minutes for questions. Yes. The dreamer was, yes.
Is that a part of this process?
Yes, that would demonstrate support for the terrified ego, you might say, from the deeper psyche, namely that the whale wasn't interested in devouring the dreamer, and he certainly wasn't interested in killing the whale. So it allowed another relationship of support. Yes. Yes, apparently women know more in this area.
And the whale come after you.
It depends on the individual. But the whale came after Jonah, you might say. Or did he go after the whale? Yeah. But the end result, he got swallowed. That's another kind of initiatory process, but it involves being devoured in the unconscious, being totally devoured by it. Well, there's plenty of terror for the dreamers in relationship to the animal, but the animal powers were wanting another kind of relationship, a relationship where they supported the ego. But the dreamer was still terrified. Does that get at your question?
I think so. They were there for the dreamer.
Exactly, exactly. They were there for the dreamer, but the dreamer didn't realize that. Right. The question is, what do the whales represent? In broad terms, the whales represent the dynamic movement or the dynamic power in the deep psyche. It's a very broad conceptualization. Yes. The question is, can this process be generalized to a society, and are the conditions the same for healing? The answer I have there is that this is very individual work, and only an individual can undertake it. It's an initiatory process for the individual, but the implications are for society. Everyone doesn't have to go through this process, but those that do will come out. Those that succeed will come out with a more creative personality, which can then engage society from a new basis. For a start, the transformed personality will be able to recognize his or her own psychopathic moments, which will therefore enable him to recognize it in others. So when others come to that person in their psychopathic moments, his reactions will begin to tell them something. He'll be able to mirror a healthful reaction to psychopathic moments. Whereas if you haven't done that work, you just mirror psychopathy back. You know, somebody tells you a psychopath, gives you, somebody is in a psychopathic moment, and you get in yours. The alchemical term for the modeling is the multiplicatio process. That if a sufficient number of individuals do the work, then a kind of a multiplicatio process takes over, where you begin to model for others the fruits of your work. Like Milarepa did, every student didn't have to go through what he went through, but they just modeled off the new personality. And that dealt with their psychopathic qualities just through the modeling of the healthful personality in a kind of osmosis. Well, it is 9:40, so shall we conclude there? That's a good place to stop. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.